talk about pop culture in some of its aspects. And today I thought I would simply give you a brief introduction into the whole area of popular literature, or trash as it's popularly called. The background for this is that I teach a course at Augustana called Trash Lit. It's called in the catalog for the benefit of parents of popular American literature, but students very quickly come to call it Trash Lit or worse. And it draws probably more students than any other course, I suppose, because someday we have a literature requirement and they have to get through it, and reading I, the Jury is probably easier than reading Moby Dick. At any rate, let me just briefly present, first of all, the history of trash, and then three of my definitions for deciding whether something is trash or not, and then open it to discussion. The history of, I suppose one could say that trash literature began in 1842, and it began in American culture, in American history. 1842 was the date of the first of a series of universal public education acts, which very quickly, within a generation or two, made universal literacy mandatory, if not actual law, throughout the country. And so within a period of about 10 years, you have 80% of the people could not read before 1842. By the 1860s, 80% could read. So you have a vast new audience, newly educated, of a kind and a class that had never been educated before. And for this new mass audience, a new literature had to be developed. The reason for that was that although they learned to read, they still had not learned to absorb culture at the level at which the elite had read it before. Before 1842, in other words, everybody who could read read everything that was written. By that I mean everybody read James Fenimore Cooper, or all classes. I don't suppose they were an actual person. Everybody read Washington Irving. There was not a New Yorker level and a National Enquirer level in our society. The trash level existed, perhaps, but just on an oral level, where people listened to it rather than read it. But with the coming of this new audience, many of whom for the first time were women, a new literature had to be developed, a literature that was easier to understand, that was faster to read, and that was consumed at a phenomenal rate compared to literature that was written before. In 1854, for instance, when Walden was published, Thoreau published Walden, they published a first edition of 1,000 copies. 4 years later, Thoreau reported in his journal that he had a library of 900 books, over 700 of which he'd written himself, that is, the 700 unsold copies of Walden. So that Walden, which is a work we look back to and respect and admire, sold almost not at all. 300 copies in 4 years. Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter, one of the great 19th century novels, sold in its first year 3,000 copies. That's a phenomenal sale for that. Longfellow, I think, in his best year, made something like $740 from literature, from his writing. At the same time that The Scarlet Letter was selling 3,000 copies, a book like Uncle Tom's Cabin was selling, and a book called The Wide, Wide World, which none of you have ever read, sold 300,000 copies apiece. So you can see the difference between an audience devoted to Hawthorne, devoted to Thoreau, and to Melville, versus the audience that is just gobbling up this mass literature at a frantic rate. Okay, the literature then that gets gobbled up by this mass audience, with the coming of radio, with the coming of television, with the coming of easy methods of printing and disseminating books, simply splits wider and wider. Until today, by 1900 actually, we really had in America, and do have today, two reading audiences. We really have more than that, actually, I suppose. There are three. There's the New Yorker audience, the Time Magazine audience, and the National Enquirer audience, and sub-audiences within that. But very seldom do you find much contact between the two audiences. That is, a person who regularly reads the New Yorker is not going to read the National Enquirer, nor True Confessions or Modern Romance at all. And the person who reads Modern Romance is not apt to, unless he teaches trash lit, to read the New Yorker. Furthermore, this split is getting further and further apart. The elitist audience, the audience that we study mostly in college, is becoming more and more limited to I think, fewer and fewer people. Maybe in this audience today, one or two of you have read a novel by John Hawkes. But John Hawkes and the people who like John Hawkes, Blood Oranges, for instance, pride themselves on the fact that he is so esoteric and so difficult that only, you know, very few people can understand him. James Joyce, when he published Finnegan's Wake in 1941, which took 17 years to write, felt that one ought to devote a lifetime to studying Finnegan's Wake. And several people have taken him seriously. The great James Joyce scholar at Northwestern University, Richard Ellman, in 1960, I believe, formed a seminar of students from all around the world, and they started at the beginning of Finnegan's Wake, and they took several pages a year, each seminar in succession. And a student of Ellman's in the second or third year of that attempt went to the University of Arkansas, where he formed a seminar, and they started at the back of Finnegan's Wake and went forward. And I think in 1969, they held a great joint party when they finally both met in the middle of the book. So that at least two people in the world have, at least two people in the world have read half of Finnegan's Wake. At the same time, most of you are completely outside the trash or mass audience too. How many of you have read the second bestseller of all times, In His Steps? Okay, one person. What? Yeah, by Reverend Sheldon. Okay, In His Steps is a book which has been read by far more people, and I'm sure has influenced far more people, for better or worse. It really, in fact, it became the rage, and I think it changed the whole scope of American religion. And yet this elitist audience, the audience that you studied normally in school, has had no contact with that kind of literature at all. None of you, I'm sure, has seen the best-selling play in America, the most produced play in America ever, which would be what, do you think? Maybe you have seen it. What do you think it would be? This play is put on and still being put on more frequently than any other play in America. Guesses?
Would that be that play in Outskirt Fish then?
The Passion Play? No, that's only put on once a year or so.
Oh, once a year? I thought they were
on. Well, it goes on for all summer. What? No, there is Charlie's Aunt, you might guess, or any of the long-running Broadway plays. But it is, in fact, and apparently it is still true that it's being put on more each year than any other play, Aaron Slick from Funk and Crick. Now, how many of you remember it? Doris Day and Ray Bolger made a movie out of it. It's the typical Little Abner kind of thing. Okay, so somewhere, you see, there's a great unwashed majority out there who is experiencing a kind of literature that just because you're here and just because most of you are college educated or at least are a part of that crowd have cut yourself off from. There is a culture, in other words, that most of us have very, very little contact with. Except as we both watch All in the Family or something like that. Okay, so the situation then is that we have a real split in reading public. a group here looking at Aaron Slick from Pumpkin Creek. Where in the world is that play ever put on? I've never seen it advertised. It's got to be put on in some small town by American Legions somewhere, because it is still being put on more than any other play. One other example of the power of the mass media to disseminate things, when Laurence Olivier did, which of the Henry plays, Henry VI, I think it was, I don't know, in 1967, more people saw that play on that single night than had seen it total since Shakespeare wrote it in the 1690s in the world. In one night, in other words, television has the power to reach more of an audience than live had ever seen that play all the way back through time. So one of the reasons, I suppose, for the importance of studying trash lit is that that's the literature that in many ways is making the kind of impact. 300 people were perhaps influenced by whatever 300 people bought Walden. But what about the 300,000 that bought Uncle Tom's Cabin, which caused Lincoln to say when he met Harry Beecher Stowe, "So you're the little lady that started the Civil War." And that's not too far wrong. I mean, that book made a tremendous impact. So did In His Steps, and I think so does stuff like Aaron Slick from Pumpkin Creek. Okay, the result then, or the response, and let me talk about this, the response of English teachers. I'm going to explain now why English teachers have such a bad reputation. The response of English teachers to this split in audience was to opt almost immediately for the elitist literature and to determine cultural standards. An English teacher, until the early 1960s, was not, and most of you have experienced English teachers before 1963, an English teacher is not really a teacher so much as a policeman. A policeman who set standards, who determined who was a gentleman or who was a fuddy-duddy, depending primarily on whether you'd read Macbeth and Silas Marner. Silas Marner is a great book, but it was voted, I think, in 1969 by a poll of seniors in every high school in the country, the most hated book in the English language. Partly that's because it was required, and it was required much too early, 10th or 11th grade. That's a dull book for a 10th or 11th grader. It's a great book if you have been to graduate school, if you have time to sit back and take a look at it. It's a very good book, but it's a very hated book in our culture, too. Those of you who have been English...
Yeah. I just wanted to concur with that, because you mentioned the title, and out of my past 10 or 11 years, I guess 12 years ago, this upswelling of disgust rolled up by this, Silas Marner.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, that disgusted me, too. David Copperfield, which I had to read. I mean, everything in Macbeth I've never been able to enjoy since then, either. But at any rate, English teachers, in a sense, by themselves, because principals and superintendents certainly didn't read literature, English teachers sat down and determined what was essential for a cultured education. And we determined that it was Macbeth, and that it was Silas Marner, and that it was one O. Henry short story, and so forth and so on. And all across the country, we perpetuated the idea that this was great literature, and that down here was literature which you shouldn't read because it would waste your time doing it. The essentially trash literature. The price we pay for that, English teachers, still is, and try this sometime if you can force yourself to do it. If you're sitting on a plane or a train or a bus or just sitting someplace in a restaurant and the person next to you asks what you do, tell them you're an English teacher. Invariably, 99 times out of 100, the other one time being a fellow English teacher, 99 times out of 100, that person will say, "Uh-oh, I guess I better watch my English." He'll move down to the next seat, look out the window, watch the clouds. He will be utterly embarrassed. He will talk about how bad his English is. He should have had more English, and he will apologize for this. Then the next time this happens, tell a person you're a physicist or a chemistry teacher. Will he say, "Oh, I better watch my chemistry. I was terrible in physics"? No, he'll say, "I've often wondered how such and such works. Can you explain to me why this..." He will get involved. He will get excited.
But then you can say, "Oh, I'm not a
Say, ha ha, fooled you, I'm an English teacher.
But you have to move that, Jason.
No, I mean, this is really one of the frustrating aspects of being an English teacher, the fact that it really turns people off. And it does that because we are self-appointed, or have been self-appointed policemen, who have determined what is great and what is not great, without bothering to explain why to the students in high school. Why is Silas Marner required? Well, just because it is. You aren't educated unless you've heard Silas Marner. Then something happened. There was a flurry of greatness for English teachers from about 1958 to 1963. 1958 was when Sputnik went up, and everybody got uptight because the Russians were so far ahead of us in education. And we went back to glorious days in which we taught term paper writing in sixth grade. Everybody read King Lear in seventh grade. And because parents wanted their children to be as educated as the Russians. So English teachers had a very great time. We could pile on 20 books, and students would dutifully read them because they were trying to catch up with the Russians. Then in 1963, and I don't know why, one of my students suggested, and maybe this is true, that it was the shock of Kennedy's assassination in 63. But virtually overnight, within a year, the whole idea of what teaching English was about changed. And we went into a thing called creativity, in which we let the student discover his own way of saying things. We went from assignments like discuss the purpose of Act 3, Scene 2 of King Lear, to sit down with a lemon, get to know the lemon, or tear a cigarette apart until you can feel the tobacco, smell the tobacco, until you are the cigarette, and then write a theme on what it means to be a cigarette, or what it means to be made into lemonade, or things like that. In which what you wanted to do was give the student some experience in telling it like it is. Beginning in 1963, English teachers soon began to learn that you weren't supposed to put red marks on students' papers, because after all, that's his idea. And can't he express his idea? Isn't his idea just as valid as your idea? A college textbook came out 3 years ago, I think, which is kind of the ultimate of this creativity trip, called "It's Mine and I'll Write It That Way," in which the whole purpose of the text is to get the student to say his way. It begins with a sentence, and I think I've committed this to memory because I've panned it enough. It begins with a sentence, does your mind work in illogical, choppy sentences? Why not? And why should we try to get the student to think logically if he doesn't? If he's a flutter budget, if he's flighty and emotional, that's him. Let him talk that way. Okay, I don't mean to knock this entirely, because I think there is something to saying it your own way and to discovering your own voice and so forth. But the result of this we're beginning to see now in the fact that students can't spell. Students can't punctuate, except that they punctuate the spell their way. So we along with this went the whole idea that there was a uniform culture which everybody had to participate in order to be cultured. But we swang and have been swinging way in the opposite direction, to the point where you can take any kind of English you want, you can read anything you want, any number of courses in high school, some of which you're probably familiar with, in which you just let the student free read. And if he picks up Hot Rod magazine, fine. If he picks up Shakespeare, fine. Assist him either way. We've gone to the idea, in other words, that the difference between Hot Rod and Shakespeare is not that one is great literature and the other is trash. It's just different kinds of things. Why make somebody who is going to be an auto mechanic read Shakespeare? Hot Rod magazine is probably going to turn him on just fine. So we have really seen in the past, and I can see this in freshmen coming to college, a real erosion of standards, an erosion of the whole concept that there are such things as standards, that there is a difference in quality of one literature over another kind of literature. That is what I where I would like to start today, and suggest, in fact, that there are standards, not as arbitrarily imposed, not as police-like imposed as we English teachers used to do in the good old days, But certainly, standards which will ultimately put Shakespeare ahead of Hot Rod magazine. And so, for purposes of discussion, I would like to suggest some ways by which one can take a work of literature and put it in a category which we would call trash, or put it in a category called great. The batting average, I might say as I begin, the batting average for English teachers in trying to do this kind of thing has never been very good. If you look at an American literature anthology written before 1924, you will discover that Herman Melville, if you discover him in the book at all, you will discover that Herman Melville was, quote, an interesting but crotchety writer of weird sea stories. In 1924, a graduate student, who even in 1924 was desperate for a topic that nobody else had covered, went back through the pages of American literature and picked up, apparently, Moby Dick and the others, wrote a brilliant dissertation on Melville, and overnight, Melville became one of the great American authors. But it wasn't because English teachers in 1952 or 51, when Moby Dick came out, it wasn't because English teachers recognized that he was great. They didn't at all. Melville couldn't even get the last half of his work published. Billy Budd was left in manuscript at his death. That also is the fate that happened to Gerard Manley Hopkins. None of his stuff was published until 1918, 20 years after his death. That also happened to John Donne and the Holy Metaphysical School, who are tremendously big at Holden. In fact, it took them 300 years to get accepted. All the way down through 300 years of English teachers, the whole metaphysical school was regarded as weird, interesting experimenters, but vile poetry. Wordsworth was regarded as sort of some kind of ultimate in Shelley. Well, T.S. Eliot single-handedly kind of reversed that. And today, Wordsworth and Shelley are so-so, and the metaphysical school, of course, are in the mainstream of the English tradition. So English teachers don't have a very good batting average, given what I'm trying to do. I'm not going to place literature, by and large, in trash or the great category, but I would like to suggest some principles that I think help determine whether a work of literature, for you at least, is great or whether it is worthless. And I suppose I would equate trash with worthless. In the first place, principle number one is whether the story is a formula story or not. A formula story is the kind of thing that I suppose the Lone Ranger exemplifies completely, in which week after week or story after story by the same author, you can come to depend upon a pet thing happening. The Lone Ranger always comes into a town. He's a stranger. Nobody knows who he is. There's a problem in the town. Somehow, by violence or by wits, he solves the problem, and then before he can be unmasked and before they can discover who he is, he's ridden off into the sunset. That happened week after week after week, year after year after year on radio, and it happens on television. And it happens in virtually every Western as well. So that one might say that nearly all Westerns are formula stories simply because they keep repeating the pattern set down by the Virginian in 1902. Very seldom do you find a Western which is any different from that formula. I forget which critic, in discussing the whole idea of formula, used the set of terms convention versus invention. All of us live in a world that is partly convention and partly invention. We need roots, that is, we need conventions, we need tradition. We have to depend upon, that is, if you're throwing a pot, it has to somehow look like previous pots that have been thrown, otherwise you aren't going to call it a pot. On the other hand, if it looks exactly like a pot that somebody else threw, it's a formula already. And if you make 10 pots, all identical, you've got a formula going. It seems to me, success in literature as well as in life consists of taking convention and adding to that invention. You can't live in a world totally of invention, especially in a world of change, a world of chaos. we need roots, and I think we need certain conventions to depend upon. But those conventions always have to be tested, probed, examined, satirized, and that's where the invention part comes in. So that one might say then that that trash literature is that literature which is almost all convention, in which somebody is simply imitating somebody else, in which Rod Serling by program number 13 is really imitating the first 13 programs that Rod Serling wrote. You can see why, of course, most mass literature has to be formula. It has to be formula because of the rapidity with which the mass market gobbles it up. Think of being Rod Serling and having to write a show a week, almost by yourself, for 2 or 3 years until you finally just run out of even parodies in your own ideas. Think of the market that television is. It's going on virtually 24 hours a day, and somebody is feeding that market with stuff. You don't have time to sit down and be inventive in the mass market. When the dime novel got written for this new audience that I talked about that became literate in 1842 and following, the dime novel consumed an immense amount of energy. The best dime novel writers were able to turn out 1 or 2 novels a week. They wrote 12 hours a day, 1,000 words an hour. Well, if you're writing, try that sometime. Most of you have if you've been to college and had a term paper due the following day. But you realize what a formula that term paper is, too. Try writing 1,000 words an hour, 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, in order to churn out the money. It allowed Ned Buntline, in that same year that Longfellow earned his top $748, it allowed Ned Buntline to earn $21,000. But so the kind of formula pays. And it takes a certain trick, I suppose, to churn out a formula story. But nevertheless, it's got to be formula because of the rapidity with which it occurs. Furthermore, there's a certain satisfaction in experiencing a formula story. Almost all of you have had the experience, if you're Perry Mason fans as we are, or any series like that, most of you are familiar with trying to tell a friend about it. You just have to watch Perry Mason. It's just a beautiful show. And then the friend comes over and looks at Perry Mason, and that night something different happens. Not Perry Mason loses, that doesn't ever go that far, but something different happens, and you explain to the friend, well, it really wasn't up to par. Why wasn't it up to par? Because the formula hadn't been followed, or the Lone Ranger doesn't get the guy. You're disappointed. So formula depends on that kind of delight we have in finding the comfortable expected. We pick up True Confessions, if we pick it up at all, knowing what we're going to find, and we're disappointed if it varies from the True Confessions formula. Popular Mechanics, Popular Science, and Mechanics Illustrated are all different magazines. And if Popular Science tried to be Mechanics Illustrated in one issue, it would get thousands of letters from the subscriber saying, what's going on here? What are you trying to do? Indicating a variation from the formula. Okay, problem with the formula is not only that it becomes incredibly dull and incredibly repetitive, and therefore ultimately meaningless except as a kind of escape. The problem with the formula story, its big problem, is that while it has to obey the formula, each new episode has to carry that formula just a bit further. Mission Impossible is a good example, and I think so is Star Trek. I think it's wise that Roddenberry didn't bring that back. Mission Impossible, if you were fans of that show when it was on, started out depending upon the formula, gimmicky mechanisms that worked but were highly improbable or very, very advanced. Okay, the second Mission Impossible show has to do that same thing, but just a little more. The machine has to be just a little more out. The escapes have to be just a little more hairbreadth. And by the time you get through, Mission Impossible just sort of ran itself out. It became so impossible that it had to drop out of existence. That, I think, to me at least, explains a lot of violence in contemporary literature. The minute in a detective story or a Mickey Spillane novel, the minute you kill one person in one story in a particularly gory fashion, you have to do it a little bit gorier in the second book and kill 2 people, then 3 people, then 4 people. So the Dashiell Hammett, for instance, who began with Sam Spade in The Maltese Falcon, which is a really great example of a hard-boiled detective story, ends with a Red Harvest in which a whole town is machine-gunned down. Because the formula has got to get more and more and more bizarre. The violence has to get more and more and more violent. Everybody's disappointed with Godfather 2 because it doesn't even have the amount of violence that Godfather 1 has. What's going on? You know, I came to see violence, and now I'm seeing less violence. Okay, so that kind of story, it seems to me, which is a formula story, could be called trash simply because it's repetitive and eventually wears itself out. It goes nowhere. Okay, B, or second, it would seem to me that one contrast between trash and quote-unquote great literature is that trash is slick, whereas great literature tends to be ragged. You might think it was the other way around, but it's not. Great literature, it seems to me, is great, whether it's Hawthorne or Melville or Shakespeare, because it leaves loose ends for the reader to tie up, to participate in. The so-called slick story, the kind that was done in Collier's and Saturday Evening Post by the hundreds of thousands throughout most of the century, was called slick partly because of that shiny paper it was printed on, but also because everything fit so neatly in its place that there was nothing left for you to do. Boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl. And at the end of the story, there are no questions left over, everything has been answered, the boy has the girl, he has a better job, and everything is nice. Boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl. And at the end of the story, there are no questions left over, everything has been answered, the boy has the girl, he has a better job, and everything is nice. That story, in a sense, leaves you standing outside of it. And it seems to me that if literature has any purpose at all, it's to get you going. It's to trigger in you something that will happen. Let me take just two examples of a slick story versus a brief example of something which I would call ragged. O. Henry wrote slick stories. Somerset Maugham wrote slick stories. You all are familiar, I'm sure, with the O. Henry story, The Gift of the Magi, in which a young husband and young wife who are poor are casting about for something to give each other for Christmas. They don't have any money. What can we do? The woman has beautiful long hair, and the man has a gold watch which he's inherited from his father, which is his only worthwhile possession. Well, suddenly it comes Christmas, and they confront each other, and what has happened is that the girl has had her hair cut off and sold it in order to buy a watch fob for his watch, because it's the man's most priceless possession. But ironically, he has sold or pawned off the watch in order to buy a band or something for her hair, a tiara. What?
Hairbrushes.
Hairbrushes for her hair, right. Beautiful, ironic, touching, but all neatly put together, slick. At the end, there are no leftover questions. You've been entertained and maybe moved even, but nothing really has happened. Let me give you another example of something you have to work at. It's one of my favorite examples of E.E. Cummings. Cummings, in talking about his mother and what a joy she was to have around, has the following sentence. She kept her sense of humor up to the very beginning. Okay, what you expect there, you see, is the neat, slick, cliche end. And when Cummings puts beginning there, suddenly you have to do something. What does he mean by beginning? Is he just trying to be clever? Or is he saying something about the relationship between life and death? Or about the fact that life really goes backwards to a beginning, and that the ending is first? You're not really sure. That is a good example, it seems to me, of something which is ragged. Cummings is not telling it for you. You have to invent the meaning for that phrase in a way that you don't in the O. Henry short story at all. Okay, what does that do? It seems to me, then, that the whole purpose of literature is to get your imagination going, to trigger in you some sort of creative response, a creative act. Trash literature is trash partly because it's so neatly done that it doesn't trigger that kind of response. I think it's Aya Richards, the psychologist literary critic, who suggested a good analogy here as to what literature is doing. He mentions the way in which a cat sharpens its claws on the furniture, and the way in which a dog will sit in the living room before he lies down and circle around three times, even though there's no grass there for the dog to flatten, no enemies for him to sense, and even though the cat, because it eats cat food, doesn't have to have sharp claws. Why does the cat do that? Instinctively, says Richards, the cat is keeping in shape against the day when it will may have to catch a mouse. And the dog, too, is keeping in shape. It gives the dog pleasure and the cat pleasure to do that because of some sort of instinctive need. Similarly, when it comes to games, we invent calisthenics and we invent football and baseball as a way of keeping our bodies in shape. It provides a kind of instinctive satisfaction because our normal jobs don't require enough effort to keep us in shape. Similarly, we play chess and checkers and mathematical games as a way of keeping our wits sharp. They create pleasure because we have that need to be ready. And in a way, one could look at literature as a kind of calisthenics of the heart or of the spirit. That is a way of, because life itself doesn't provide us with situations in which we're really confronted with danger or with meaningful relationships, of becoming for a moment Hamlet during the course of that play and keeping our hearts in tune. Coleridge, I think, said it even better, even earlier than I.A. Richards said it. Coleridge suggests that the whole purpose of literature is to exercise your imagination, and the imagination, says Coleridge, is the one way you have of getting outside your own ego, of becoming for a moment something else, a tree or an animal or another human being, of bridging that gap that ultimately separates all of us, of for a moment becoming Hamlet or becoming King Lear and seeing what it must be like to be somebody else, of literally putting yourself in somebody else's shoes. And so for Coleridge, then, the one thing, the one hope for human brotherhood, the one hope for human community, lies in the arts. Because by exercising the imagination, which is sympathetic, that is, it introduces us to something outside ourselves, we are made more compassionate. So the purpose of literature for Coleridge is again, as a kind of calisthenic. Hopefully, once we have put the book down, our sympathies have been strengthened and we will be able to go out into the world stronger human beings with more of a need and more of a capacity for brotherhood. A slick story is trash, I think, because it doesn't do that. A good story is great not because it has a great message. Many stories we appreciate whose messages we don't agree with at all. We can't. It would be hard for us both to agree with the world of Thomas Hardy and the world of Joseph Conrad, but there's no reason why any of us can't enjoy both of those works of art. It's because we're not being taught messages, but we're experiencing the work of art itself. It's the experience that's important because it stretches our sympathies and hopefully. Of course, you see where that leads. It makes English teachers the most compassionate, understanding, and loving of all people. So there are probably some holes in that argument. But at least I like how Coleridge's idea that what literature is doing to you is not preaching. It's giving you a chance to exercise a part of you. Yeah.
I think one of the best ways to illustrate that from the point of view of Christian understanding is in C.S. Lewis's works, where he handles concepts that we oftentimes take literally from the scriptures and throws them into a way of thinking that doesn't allow for us to go away with a simple kind of definition. I mean, not only in the Narnian stories where it's the analogies to Christ or Aslan and the justification, redemption aspects of it, but also I found out in the Great Divorce and the concept of heaven and hell, very hard there to, you know, in terms of struggling with that. And I feel really respond to that, because I think this is something that is very hard for me to do. And I wonder how, but I agree that there is a power there that we have not tapped very effectively in the church. And I think it'd be something that I'd really be interested in.
Well, Lewis is a perfect example, I think, of what I'm talking about here. I mean, he really makes you are Auslan when you read the Narnia. I mean, if you haven't read those Narnia books, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and Down to the Last Battle, read those, because those are as far removed from trash as I mean, there is a just an unexplained kind of power, I think, in those books. Okay, let me just quickly move. I ended up preaching the whole period, but let me just toss out reason three, or division three, between trash and great literature. It seems to me that trash is that literature, and for each of us that is probably different, which confirms ideas that we already hold, which makes us, in other words, further into the rut, more set in our ways. And that great literature for us is great because it confronts. So here again, this other neat division that I've been tracing, confirm versus confront. That in terms of the Holden theme this summer, great literature is that which makes us new every morning. Trash literature is that which prevents that from happening. I have had the experience, and I'm sure most of you have too, of finding out that it was always, when I was in grade school, it was always the kid that I started out beating up, or beating me up usually, on the playground, that I became best friends with, and that I have stayed with the most. And it's that friend that I liked instantly that very quickly disappeared. Why did I like that friend instantly? I suppose because he or she was so much like me. Isn't the ideal friendship to have as wide a difference as possible with still some sort of bridge in between? Maybe not so much in friendship or marriage or in the rest of life, but it seems to me true in literature. And I suppose that explains why it's so hard for a work like Walden or Moby Dick or another great work of literature to become accepted. They're always threatening. If a work of literature is not threatening, then it's not doing anything for you. It's not shocking. It's not awakening you. It's not, it seems to me, the function of great literature to give answers, but to ask disturbing questions, to change you, in other words, to take that smugness that is always where we're at the moment and break it open and raise other possibilities in a very real kind of way. I don't think a work like Moby Dick or a work like The Scarlet Letter answers any questions at all in the way that Somerset Maugham and O. Henry do, and Treves does in all the way through. It's the function to disturb, to confront, rather than to confirm. Yeah.
I guess I agree with half of what you say, because I can really identify with the idea of literature confronting you and really forcing you to probe some of your thoughts and feelings. Except that along with that, I don't think I would continue reading works by someone who was expressing thoughts and feelings that I just couldn't relate to or identify with at all. Something that was so alien.
I wouldn't either, and that's why there's some literature that for me is too confronting, and I would consider that esoteric and elitist, because that just the high guys understand that. Sure, we're all at different points on this thing. McLuhan has a beautiful analogy, I think, that would be a good place to end. He said one day there was an ant who lived in an ant colony. He was a very curious ant, and he explored the ant colony inside out until he got to know the whole ant colony. And he thought he really knew. I mean, he could tell others what the meaning of the ant colony, its dimensions and so forth were, until one day, by accident, he went out the wrong hole, and there he was, flowers, trees, sunshine, grass. And suddenly that ant in chagrin looked back on that little ant colony and said, wow, was was I ever misguided? Was I ever limited in my vision of what the ant colony is like? Now, I'm in the world and I can look at the ant colony perspective and I really see it for the kind of little part of the world that it really is. And this ant was very smug and happy because he really had the truth, where the poor blind ant struggling down the ant colony didn't know what life was like at all. Until one day he got further and further from the ant colony and went through a door and looked back and for the first time realized that he'd been in a greenhouse. That wasn't the real world, that grass and trees and stuff in there, and the ant colony and the greenhouse. Here was the real world, vast, you couldn't even see the end of it. And so this ant very smugly said, now I can really see the ant colony in perspective. I have an understanding of it that is so far ahead of those poor ants back in the ant colony, and the few that have made it up to the greenhouse. But of course, what the ant never did find out, because he didn't live that long, was that the greenhouse was sitting in the middle of the Astrodome. And that beyond the Astrodome, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, one might define trash literature. I suppose the success of a work like Peyton Place is because Grace Metalius is so much in the ant colony. She really understands it. Sinclair Lewis understood small town American life in Main Street. But when the society, you know, when the rest of the colony gets beyond that, then that kind of literature disappears very, very quickly. And that's why Peyton Place comes and goes. That's why anything that becomes a bestseller, very quickly, the culture goes beyond it. And you look back at it and you see Sinclair Lewis, wow, what a silly book Main Street is. Whereas once we thought it was really great. That might also explain why we take a look in 1850 at Moby Dick and say, what is that weirdo talking about? But by 1924, we'd gotten through several environments, and we were finally where Melville was in 1850.
I guess, as far as identifying or just empathizing, I'm thinking of the Last Picture Show, which to me was, I guess, one of the shallowest movies I've ever seen, and it got raves, and it was just built up as one of the best, and there were certain aspects that I could see were...
I thought it was one of the greatest I'd ever seen.
See? It was just to me... Okay, I love it.
Here it is back in the ant colony. No, I
don't. It was just nothing. And yet, okay, yeah, this goes on, yeah, this happens, but there wasn't a feeling that I could relate to with anybody on that screen.
Yeah, well, this analogy, I like this analogy of the ant colony, but it becomes increasingly complicated, because I suppose as far as literature is concerned, I would put myself a couple environments ahead of people who are not English teachers. But my theology, my theology is pure ant colony theology. You know, I'm not to the greenhouse yet when it theologically, nor am I musically or artistically or as far as the movies are concerned. So that each of us, I suppose, in various aspects of the culture that surrounds us are at various stages. But for me, that analogy of the ant colony would explain why the writers who are destined to become great are so misunderstood in their time. I mean, they're just environments ahead. And so what they say lasts. In Shakespeare is so far outside the Astrodome that nobody is ever going to catch up with him. The minute an age catches up with the writer and understands as much as he understands, then why read him anymore? See, but the very greatest writers, that never happens to. But it will happen to Grace Metalius, it will happen to Jacqueline Suzanne, it will happen to that kind of literature which is trash because it's a product of its environment rather than the environments that lie ahead of it.
You mean Jaws isn't going to last forever?
I don't... Well, I won't be around to... No, I don't think so. At all. Although it could. I mean, that'd
be a month.
Jaws has a certain... Yeah. Jaws has a certain fascination, too. Yeah.
You have to, but I don't think anybody should get so smug that they don't realize that people read a lot of things just for pure enjoyment. And you can read Jaws and see all the bad writing. I mean, the dialogue is ridiculous a lot of the time. But there's an intrigue in that is not necessarily easy for everybody to write down. Yes, you see what I mean? I mean, and it's, I think the problem with teaching English in schools a lot, they don't let kids read for pure enjoyment.
Well, but isn't there a difference? I think I basically agree with you that I suppose I was being negative when I called trash trash. I mean, I guess I was, right?
Well, but trash.
But there's a place for it. You know, I mean, we can't go around being confronted all the time either. And to say, Vincent Millay's, my candle burns at both the ends, it gives a lowly light, but ah, my foes and all my friends, it shall not last tonight. I mean, that's nice and romantic when you're under 30, you know, to live so intensely that you bring yourself out of 30, but, you know, that would have meant ditto for me, you know, long ago, and I'm no longer so willing to accept that kind of notion. No, I think we need a lot of confirmation and a lot of formula, particularly in a world that just seems to be going here and there.
Can you tell me why, I mean, I'm in high school and I am so sick and tired. Everything you read, what is the inner meaning of this? What is she trying to do? Why is she acting this way? I am sick and tired of trying to figure out, trying to brain pick everybody in this story and trying to figure out. I would like to sit down once and say, here, read the story just for the story. I can see where you have to find themes and something.
I guess that's what I was saying. I would agree with Coleridge. The purpose of any work of art is to experience it, and to be stretched by that experience. And then afterwards, now, see, I can take a story and ask those kinds of questions and get turned on by asking them. But I can see many people don't. So I don't think there's ever anything for enjoyment. I think enjoyment is simply the trigger that gets you going. You've all had that experience, I'm sure. I hope you have. And when you're reading a book and you get so involved in it, you forget you're reading it. Well, at that point, that work is doing what literature ought to do to you. It's turning you on, and it's exercising that sympathetic imagination that you have. And for you, at that moment, that work is not trash.
I had an experience with a movie. Once here, getting into a different thing here, but I think it might apply to what you said reminded me of. I saw the film, and I wasn't sure whether I liked it or whether I hated it. You know, I mean, it had elements in it of violence that really revolted me, and yet there were things about it that I thought were great. But I couldn't pull my thoughts together on it at all. And if I had been pressed on it at that point, I think I would have not only hated the film, but hated the people who were trying to get me to think about it. But 6-7 months later, I was up here. And that film came up in a discussion, and a person said a few things about that film that pulled that together for me, you know. And suddenly I thought, yeah, wow, that is a really great film.
Except, see, now the difference between the high school class and that is that hers is an unnatural way of going about it, because at 10:50 every day you have to sit down and say, what does this mean?
That's what I mean. I wasn't pressed.
Whereas to you, you I see, it came time. In the natural course of time, I think that's much better.
Yeah.
But the problem, you see, for us English teachers to defend that approach is if you say, let's read the work and then say, wow, what do you do the rest of the 15 minutes? Right? We got to invent something. We got to invent something to fill the time. And so we say, what did this character, who's the hero? What was the main character? Why did the setting contribute? See? Because those you can fill 50 minutes of. Wow, you can't. You say it, you get it.
I have another
principals
question.
Principals don't like that.
Yeah. there's been a lot of talk lately about disaster films, disaster books. Why is American society so interested in things like that right now? You know, Poseidon Adventure, Towering Inferno,
Earthquake. What was the joke about that? They're going to combine Earthquake with Towering Inferno, Shake and Bake?
Yeah.
I think people like to see disasters, and given the formula, each one has to be worse than the other.
Why do people rush out and launch a fire, chase an ambulance?
Yeah.
That's why Jaws is so popular now, for the same reason, because it's a thing that's so real, yet it's a big disaster play.
It's, you know, people are really, they get rather rough. I was involved in a shooting situation as part of my job, and I was astounded that the people who flocked to the corners to watch the shootout weren't killed, you know, right in the line of fire, you know. Oh, wow, you know. It's incredible. I'm part of the shotgun, and I'm not standing out there watching anything. But these people with their kids, you know. Oh, look, see, they're in that house there. See, look at the flashes of light coming out the window.
And look how disappointed people are when they when the guy doesn't jump.
They were disappointed when he wasn't shot. Yeah. He gave up. And it was disappointed because he wasn't shot. That was very, very real.
It's the same with watching the news, you know. We talk about somebody getting murdered. Do they have a film about it? You know.
It is. It's time to eat.
Okay.
You're welcome.